everybody. We're back. I'm Karen Hartglass. Thanks for joining me for the second part of today's program. And I want to get right to it with my guest, Stephen M. Wise. He is the president of the Non-Human Rights Project. He holds a JD from Boston University Law School and a BS in chemistry from the College of William and Mary. He has practiced animal protection law for 30 years throughout the United States and is admitted to the Massachusetts Bar. Steve teaches animal rights jurisprudence at the Vermont Lewis and Clark University of Miami and St. Thomas Law Schools, and he has taught animal rights law at the Harvard Law School and John Marshall Law School. He's the author of four books, Rattling the Cage, Drawing the Line, Through the Heavens May Fall, and my favorite, an American trilogy, Death, Slavery, and Dominion Along the Banks of the Cape Fear River. He is also working on a fifth, which will be a memoir about the Non-Human Rights Project. Welcome to It's All About Food. Stephen, how are you today?
I'm doing fine. Thank you for having me on.
You're welcome, and I hope you had a very happy birthday yesterday.
I did, yes. Thank you. Thank you.
It was, I don't know, it was an odd day for us, kind of with this strange bit of hope that the Electoral College would turn a different way, but it didn't. But aside from that, we have much work to do. So I had the opportunity to meet you a few weeks ago. You were speaking in Brooklyn, and yep. It was great to hear you in person. I want to what impressed me the most, I don't know why I just realized it at that point in time when you were speaking, but how you are working to move the law in such a tiny increment. And I was just fascinated by that and your approach and your patience. Can you talk a little about that work?
Sure. Well, I do have a lot of patience. I'm very persistent. I had begun working as an animal protection lawyer in 1981, and I began working with what became the Animal Legal Defense Fund. I became president of that for 10 years. And by 1985, 1986, I'd been persuaded that there was a real problem with respect to how the law dealt with non-human animals, that the law saw them all as legal things, which means that they lack the capacity to have any kind of legal rights, as opposed to legal persons, which is the capacity to have to have at least some legal rights, and that until non-human animals were seen as persons, they could be expected to be treated just like human beings treat all their other property. They don't act in the interest of their property; they act in their own interests. And essentially, a person is the master of things. Things are slaves to us persons. And so I began to plan how we would begin to move at least some non-human animals from the legal category of things, again, who lack the capacity for any kind of legal right, to legal persons who have the capacity for at least some. And the ones we're looking for are those that protect their most fundamental interests. And at that time, I thought it would take 1985, 86, I thought it would take about 30 years of preparation before we'd be able to even file the first lawsuits that had some kind of a reasonable chance of success. And there was so much to do because if you can go back to 1985, there was very little talk of animal rights in any kind of a technical legal way. There weren't very many lawyers. There were no case books. There were no law schools who taught it. There were no law review articles about it. There were no organizations except the Animal Legal Defense Fund. And also, the world was in a very different place with respect to non-human animals. And so altogether, I figured it would take probably 30 years before the world had turned, and we had prepared for those kinds of cases. And it did indeed take 28 years.
Wow.
1985 is when I began, and then the Non-Human Rights Project began filing its first series of lawsuits on behalf of chimpanzees in the state of New York, habeas corpus lawsuits, in December of 2013.
That's a lot of patience and a lot of wonderful foresight. So thank you for getting started that so long ago.
Well, there's a... There's a film out about it. It's called Unlocking the Cage by Chris Hedges and D.A. Pennybaker, which actually is going to be on HBO on February 20th on President's Day. And I remember going in and speaking with them about whether, and they're trying to figure out whether they're going to shoot the film, and they wanted to see me, and I thought they probably want to see whether I'm a lunatic or whether whether that, you know, I'm serious about this. Because if you say someone had an idea and it's going to take them 28 years before they can move on it, you could either be a lunatic or you could be somebody who's deadly serious. And I think they realized soon that I was deadly serious, and they agreed to make the film. And indeed, it took 4 years to make, and it premiered at the Sundance Film Festival in January, and now it's been playing around the world, and it's going on HBO on February 20th.
Well, congratulations, and I look forward to seeing it. I remember when it came here to New York, and unfortunately, I was in California for a good amount of that time, so I missed it when it was here, and I look forward to seeing it in February. I'm going to have to find somebody who has HBO.
Indeed.
But I think I can do that. All right, so you've expanded the mission of the Non-Human Rights Project. Can you talk about that?
Yes. Well, we originally were planning on just filing lawsuits, and specifically we began by filing habeas corpus lawsuits on behalf of captive chimpanzees. We've begun moving that to filing other sorts of lawsuits in states other than the state of New York on behalf of other animals. So our next lawsuit will be on behalf of elephants in a circus. We have a lawsuit after that. We'll probably go after chimpanzees being used in entertainment, where we always have an idea. We're looking at SeaWorld in San Diego and trying to figure out how we may be able to file lawsuits against SeaWorld. But we're also moving into the legislative department, not at the state level or the federal level, but we've been working on how to try to get ordinances passed that would make certain non-human animals legal persons who have the capacity for rights at the municipal level, at the county level, or at the city level, at the town level. And so we're beginning to do that. We're beginning to get more deeply into a public education program, basically so that we can continue to make people understand why we're doing what we're doing. And also, we think that will make it easier for us to win at the legislative level as well as in front of judges, because they'll have a much better idea as to, from a legal point of view, why we're doing what we're doing. But also, we never do anything on behalf of a non-human animal that we haven't already lined up the world's great experts in the cognition of that non-human animal. And so they will then judges, legislators, and others will be able to really get an idea as to what kind of extraordinary mind so many of these non-human animals have. And we're beginning to focus. We focus first on the great apes, chimpanzees, bonobos, gorillas and orangutans, also on Indian Asian and African elephants, as well as some dolphins and whales. Those are the non-human animals who we're starting with. And one of the reasons we're starting with them is because there is so much known about their minds that it's clear that they have these extraordinarily complex minds. And we want other people to understand what we understand by getting all sorts of facts together, lining up experts, and letting people know, you know, what kind of beings we're living with on this planet.
Something that fascinated me when I heard you speak in Brooklyn as well is talking about the law and how you can make changes in the law, kind of how it builds on itself. And right now, a lot of us are feeling a lot of despair because of the future of the federal government with the man who will be president very soon and who he's choosing to be part of his cabinet and staff. And it's somewhat scary. And some of us are thinking that our civil rights are going to be taken away to some degree. But you're focusing on working on the state level, and now you're talking about the municipal level. And tell me why that's important.
Well, I think it's important because, first of all, they're independent. We work on state common law, actually, and the common law is the law that judges make while they're in the process of deciding cases. And it doesn't have anything to do with federal law at all. So there could be a lot of things going on at the federal level that would not affect us because we're working at the common law level, which and the common law has been around for 800 or 900 years. And it slowly changes, but it's made to be flexible, to change according to how the public experience changes, public mores change, how scientific facts continue to accrue. And so the arguments we have been making and continue to make at the common law level, we'll continue to make no matter who's sitting on the U.S. Supreme Court or who's sitting in, who's sitting on the federal benches. At the municipal level, we're actually looking at those states that have so-called constitutional home rule, which means that within their state constitutions, there are provisions that allow them to legislate in a way that they cannot be overridden at the state level. And they're almost like little states themselves. The cities and towns within that state have the power of the state. And so we want to go into to make our arguments at a smaller level, like a county level or city level, as well as making common law arguments at the state level. We think it's the way to really get our foot into the door. And so that's why we've chosen that. Once you go to the federal level, you're dealing with either federal statutes, which there are very, very few federal statutes that protect non-human animals, or you're dealing with federal courts who rarely have jurisdiction over non-human animal issues. So we think starting at the state level and the municipal level is the way that we want to begin.
Can you tell us what's going on around the world on this subject? I think there's some positive things that have been happening.
I can tell you. Yes, one of the non-human rights projects might be working at the municipal level and the state level, and we skip our federal level, but we skip right up to the international level. And so we have been working slowly with lawyers in, I think, 10 countries now, in France and England, Switzerland, Spain, Portugal, Argentina, Brazil, India, Australia, New Zealand, trying to impart whatever help we can give to them to try to get legal rights for non-human animals. Working with them so we can share whatever experience we have, and we may be able to learn from them as well. And I think the country where we're having the most success is Argentina. There was a case about 2 months ago where a chimpanzee in Mendoza, Argentina, where a chimpanzee named Cecilia was also the subject of a writ of habeas corpus that was really modeled on our work. The arguments made about the cognition of Cecilia, a chimpanzee, was also modeled on our work. So we were really happy to see that. And also, I had spent a week down in Buenos Aires and Bahia Blanca in Argentina in May speaking with lawyers. So I knew how eager people were to be able to push this sort of thing forward. So a judge then did indeed grant a writ of habeas corpus and ordered a chimpanzee named Cecilia to be taken from the Mendoza Zoo and sent to a sanctuary in Brazil. And so I think that's really the first time at least that a writ of habeas corpus has been used successfully all the way. We have been successful. We've had a judge in Manhattan issue a writ of habeas corpus, or in New York they would call it an order to show cause. That was the first time that it happened in the world. And that required Stony Brook, who was imprisoning two chimpanzees named Hercules and Leos, to actually come into court and defend for the first time in history their imprisonment of a non-human animal. When we had the habeas corpus hearing, the judge ruled in our favor all the way down the line, except for one thing. She felt bound by a previous ruling in another part of New York that had gone against us. And so she said, I'm going to have to deny your writ of habeas corpus, quote, for now, unquote. And now we're actually going into an appellate court in New York City in January on behalf of Tommy the chimpanzee, and the same appellate court in February on behalf of Kiko the chimpanzee, trying to persuade that court to tell the judge who had ruled against us that she doesn't have to pay attention to that other case, that that case was decided wrongly.
So you keep chipping away, and these judges look for kind of an excuse because they don't have the courage to rule in favor of your
judges. Case. You know, they're not all cut from the same cloth. You know, some judges are very conservative. Some judges are much more liberal. Some are willing to have their picture on the front page of newspapers. Some are not willing to have their picture on the front page of newspapers. And they're broad and diverse kinds of judges. And so we really can't pick the ones we're going in front of. And so we kind of make our arguments in front of the judges we get. And even in the first 3 years, we've gotten a wide variety of judges. And some judges we've done much better in front of than others. So, in fact, when you watch the film, which, by the way, is called Unlocking the Cage, you can watch one or two judges kind of ream me out about what I'm trying to do. And then you can find other judges who are very, very sympathetic to it. And it's just kind of how they're made, what their value systems are, and also what kind of a case they think we're filing. For example, do they think we're filing a property case because a chimpanzee's property, or do they think we're filing a civil rights case because we're asking for a legal right for a non-human animal? So we think a judge who kind of intuitively believes that she has a property case in front of her is going to rule against us, while a judge who kind of intuitively thinks that she has a civil rights case in front of her may tend to rule in our favor. So there, we have an immense amount of patience, and we just apply as much pressure as we can. We also speak to our brothers and sisters in the legal profession by continuing to write and publish series of law review articles in which we explain at much greater length the legal arguments that we're using in our cases, so that judges and lawyers and law clerks can read them and understand what we're doing. And it's also something that we can cite to in our briefs. And again, the judges or their clerks can go to these articles and get a better understanding than they might be able to get even by reading our briefs, because there's always a page limit on our briefs, but there's not really a page limit on our books or law review articles. An oral argument in front of a judge may end up taking 15 minutes. So there's not a whole lot that you can really talk about in 15 minutes. So
I'm just curious about Stony Brook and what their argument was to keep these animals imprisoned.
Well, I'm afraid I'm not really clear what it is sometimes. You can watch the lawyer for Stony Brook, who is an assistant attorney general, make the arguments. I think the most important arguments were, number one, judge, this has never been done before. You shouldn't do it now. And that's the argument that anybody makes who wants to keep the status quo. When someone else comes in and says, hey, it's time because of new scientific evidence or changes in the law, it's time to move something in a different direction. The person doesn't want to move. They'll say, hey, we don't know what's going to happen. We shouldn't be doing this. That kind of argument they make all the time. And then they make another kind of argument, which in law is known as the slippery slope, which is, judge, if you grant habeas corpus to a chimpanzee and get her out of her cell and put her on in a sanctuary, well, that means then chimpanzees are going to want to come in and they're going to want to vote, and they're going to want to go to college, they're going to want to get married, And so you shouldn't start down this dangerous trail. It's a slippery slope. And the judge, in her opinion, in the Stony Brook case, specifically addressed this slippery slope argument and said, I don't buy it. If the party in front of me is entitled to justice, he'll get it. And then we'll let the next judge decide the next case, which I think is the appropriate answer to a slippery slope argument.
Okay, Steve, this is difficult. This work, this is challenging work. This is time-consuming work. It costs money. How can we help? What can people do?
Well, if you would like to donate to us, you're certainly you can go to our website, which is www.nonhumanrights.org, and you'll find a donate button. And also, you will find that everything that we file, or everything an opponent files, or everything a judge does, everything, whether we like it or not, goes up on our website. We're also the website that you see in December is not going to be the website that's going to go up in January, because we're spending money to really change our whole website to make it much, much easier for people to follow. And also, if you're interested in just working anywhere in the United States, really anywhere in the world, for the same sorts of things that the Non-Human Rights Project is interested in, we are expanding. We're beginning to actually put people into district captains kind of in each state. And so we'll be able to talk with you, not right now, but by March or April, we'll be able to talk to you about what you might be able to do to help our work in the state in which you are living.
Okay. Very good. Thank you. Thank you, Stephen
M. Wise. Thanks so much for having me on.
Yes. Thank you for keeping it up for so many decades, doing what you're doing.
You're very welcome. Thanks for having me on.
Okay, happy holidays. All right, that was Stephen M. Wise of the Non-Human Rights Project. You can find more at the nonhumanrights.org website, www.nonhumanrights.org. How awesome is that for someone to be working for the voiceless and improving the legal rights for those who are sentient and are smart and cannot represent themselves in our legal system, which is so abusive to them. Okay, we just have a couple of minutes left, and I wanted to bring you back to responsibilityandliving.com, where we work to make life lovely and delicious while making it better for the planet and better for those non-human animals that many choose to look at as food, which we at responsibilityandliving.com do not. And we give you all the good reasons not to consume animals for food, because the food is so yummy and delicious. You know, we were talking about anxiety before and energy, and we make these super duper green power smoothies at home. And when we do, I just can't believe how sated I am and how much energy I have all day long. So if you're looking to really be energized, you might try one of these. They are green. They are super green. And they are fully loaded with all good things. And you can find it at responsibleeatingandliving.com. Again, I want to mention, as I mentioned at the beginning of the program, that responsibleeatingandliving.com is a nonprofit, and I am offering for those who donate $35 or more this book, 25 Women Who Survived Cancer, Notable Women Sharing Inspiring Stories of Hope. I have contributed a chapter, and at Responsibility and Living, we do offer free consultations for people in a health crisis with cancer. And you can help support our work doing that with a donation. And you can also get a book. It makes a great stocking stuffer. All right. Thank you for joining me on It's All About Food. And you can find me at info@realmeals.org if you have some comments and questions. We are here to serve deliciously. Okay. Have a really delicious week.